Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What if it's like the herdsman, but like instead of H-E-R-D, it's H-E-A-R-D, like herd our music?
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantee is implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
They try to locate a Saffron to get in contact with my pilot, right?
I have agreed to nothing.
You're in a bit of a conundrum there, my friend. You know what that means? It means you have no choice.
Hello, everybody.
Ah!
It is Recotopia, episode 62. The big recommend will be Blood Diamond from 2006. Hello, I'm Chris Atkinson.
I'm Jeremy Scott.
How you doing today, Jeremy?
I'm doing pretty well. I got up 2 or 3 hours earlier than normal for me today. So
that's not good.
I'm all right now, but I'll be dragging in a few hours. But I'm excited. I'm excited to talk about today's big recommend and the smalls as well.
Once again, acknowledging the chat who's here today, looks like a lot of the usual suspects. Thank you so much for coming out and watching us on a Tuesday. What are your small recommends, Jeremy?
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Well, I am doing the Jeremy thing where neither of my recommends this week are movies. But I'm going to start out with a video game that came out the week after the Masters, the week of the Masters. It's called EA Sports PGA Tour 2023. And
oh, look at that cover.
You can, you can get this game for, I believe, all of your major systems. I have a PS5 plug in the very near future, I believe, Thursday of this week to those listening live. Thursday of last week to those listening on delay. Dicer and Ian and I are going to battle it out on the golf courses, streaming on Twitch on this game. And I will give you the caveat right out of the gate. So far, the game is inconsistent in terms of if I feel like I hit the perfect shot with the perfect aim twice in a row, the ball could end up in two different places. But they are actively making updates. The first major update they made nearly crashed the game and made it really buggy for several hours. They're adding a new swing style because people are used to the three-click swing in a golf video game. Anyway, I'm saying this all in reverse. Here's why I'm recommending this game. This is the most beautiful sports video game I've ever seen in my life. The graphics are incredible. At moments, near lifelike. And part of this is the technology, because they got access to Augusta National, for example, where they play the Masters. They got access to that club's horticultural botany tree information down to the height of each plant and the location. So it looks exactly like that place looks. And it has been a long time since you've been able to play Augusta National on a proper golf video game. And so that in and of itself is worth buying the game for, but it also has all the other major courses, Pebble Beach, Scottsdale, TPC Sawgrass, all four majors of this year, 2023 in real life, all four of those courses are in this game. So you can play along with the actual season as they go from course to course and major to major. So I'm very much looking forward to playing this game more and playing in a fun competitive environment on Twitch, but also playing by myself. You can create your own player. It has a pretty awesome career mode. But again, courses out the ass and the most beautiful game I may have ever seen. And so that's why it's my first small recommend.
I still haven't seen frames of this, so I may have to, you know, take a look at you guys watching playing this game on Thursday. It'll be fun. What time are you guys doing that?
I believe we're going in the afternoon, 3 Central, I believe.
Okay.
But I will tell you when we get closer, and I'll tweet it out and stuff like that.
Sweet. All right. This is a new one for me in the post-COVID era. It just seemed like this is like the third or fourth time in a row I've gone to the movie theater. And I went to go see Renfield, directed by Chris McKay, starring Nicolas Cage and Nicholas Holt. You've seen the trailer. You know that Nicholas Holt plays Renfield. He is going to a group therapy because he is in a toxic relationship with Dracula, played by Nicolas Cage. They rip this right from the original Bela Lugosi Dracula. They digitally insert Cage and Holt into the original Dracula to show the story of them meeting and everything. But now we're in the modern day. It's been, you know, they've lived with each other for hundreds of years now. Nicholas Holt is seeing the modern world, and he is out there trying to find victims for Nicolas Cage, who many years ago was caught some sort of religious magical circle of some sort, and he ended up getting burned really badly in it. Nicholas Holt ends up messing up the circle that this priest has made, and Dracula is able to get out, but he's been badly burned. So for the past several decades, he's been recovering, and Nicholas Holt has been trying to find him victims. Renfield has some of the power there. Explained, he has some of the powers of Dracula dialed way down, so he can, if he gets into a situation, he can handle himself pretty well. He gets caught up in caught up with this mafia or this gangster family or whatever. The main guy that you would recognize here is Ben Schwartz. Plays the spoiled mob guy who hasn't really ever gotten his hands dirty, and the family is run by I don't know if I'll ever get this name right. I don't think I've ever heard it pronounced, but she's been in a million things. Shore Agadashlu, I think, something like that is her name.
Okay, yeah.
She is the head of that family. So a lot of the things that Renfield and this family do get sort of mixed up, and we have a cop played by Awkwafina. Her dad was killed by this mob family back in the day, and now she's a cop, and her sister's an FBI agent, and sort of all this stuff is just kind of like melding together. There's the crime element, there's his therapy sessions, he's falling in love with Awkwafina, all this other stuff is going on. A lot of stuff going on here. The violence is over the top. It's ridiculous. It's like, it's super bloody, but like hilarious in the way. Like it's not, you'll sit there and go gross and then laugh. It's just really good time. I don't know if this is, people are really responding to this. It got a B, I think a B minus cinema score over the weekend. It didn't do well. And then like an $8 million domestic opening. But it's destined to kind of get a cult following over the years, I think. So I think you would enjoy this one, Jeremy. I really liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun.
The first trailer that I, the only trailer that I saw, I really liked. And actually, I saw an interview where McKay said it's a direct sequel to that 1931 film, and everybody was like, what the fuck? But if you're telling me they digitally reinserted these characters into that movie, then I get what he's saying in terms of, we wanted to take that bit and then jump forward in time and show their relationship now. Nicholas Holt, fast rising up my list of must-watch actors.
He's awesome. I've like the past few years, I think starting with Mad Max, and then going on into like The Favorite and that show with Elle Fanning that I can never think of the name of for some reason. The Great. Yes. He is awesome in all of those. He was great in this past year's The Menu as well. He's definitely he's half the reason why I wanted to watch this movie was that he was in it at this point. So very, 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 very good.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. For my second small recommend, I have a food product to share. But I would like to start. I would like to open with the acknowledgement that all corporations are generally terrible and treat their workers poorly. And that when you choose to go to a grocery store, you are simply choosing which evil corporation you want to give money to in exchange for food. Sometimes that corporation for me ends up being Kroger. They are the number one grocer in the U.S. And even though your local stores may not be called Kroger, they own Ralph's and King's and Fred Meyer and all these other chains. And they have a lot of their own products, just like any grocery store like Publix does these days. They have their own store brand products, right? Mm-hmm. And I spied the other day, Kroger Simple Truth, that's the organic brand.
Yep.
Pink Himalayan salt and pepper pistachios.
Ooh.
He found a photo of it. Oh my God. I wonder if he went to the store and bought one and then no, he probably find that on Google. That's amazing. I was not a pistachio guy. I don't know if I'd ever had them until
they're awesome.
A meal we went to where the dessert was pistachio ice cream. And that was the first time I realized how much like peanuts they could be. And I've been eating them as a snack ever since. That was, 5 years ago? I prefer not to have a shell because I'm lazy and I don't like to do work. But they didn't have this kind unshelled. So I bought it anyway. And hey, good news. It's not very hard to shell a pistachio, and even better news, these taste freaking awesome. And I'm addicted. I'm almost all the way through this bag. I've only had it for 2 days. Help me. So if you have a Kroger or a Kroger owned store near you and you are willing to give an evil corporation a few dollars for some tasty pink Himalayan salt and pepper pistachios, then go and do it. They're also very good for you and healthy, packed with nutrients.
I will have to try these. I love me some pistachios, man. That's a good old snack right there.
Absolutely.
My second small recommend is a movie that I saw with people on a movie night, and one of the movies that was chosen was Memories of Murder, which is a Bong Joon-ho movie back in 2003. And you already recognize that Song Kang-ho is in this movie. He is in almost all of the Bong Joon-ho movies. This movie is wild in its presentation because it is about a serial killer and the detectives who are trying to find who that person is. And, you know, the two people, I'm trying to remember if I think the one that Song Kang-ho plays, he's a buffoon. Like at first you're like, he's the man of authority in this. He's the one who discovers the body at the beginning of this movie. And you're like, he's the only person of reason in this entire movie right now, until you start seeing other people come in who are a little bit more serious about how you solve crimes and everything. This is just a serial killer thing, and they're just chasing down leads, and I would imagine there's a lot of frustrating things like this in casework like this, where you see somebody do something that's weird or it's a coincidence of some sort, and that person becomes your biggest suspect, but everything else doesn't add up for them to be the actual person or whatever. They first arrest this guy who has and I don't know what his affliction is. I don't even want to bother like trying to speculate what it is, because that would be wrong. But they basically arrest this guy at the very beginning, thinking he's the one who did it, because people saw him following the victim on the night of the murder. And then they beat this guy up. They do a whole bunch of stuff to keep him away from his family. They do all this. And finally, he does something which feels like a confession. But if you listen to that confession, you'll notice some details that are off about it. But yet the details are very accurate about how this murder went down and everything. They think he's the best suspect, but then another murder happens. And so it's obvious that it's not him. And they continue following other leads. This movie is strange though. It's got so many different parts to it. It's in part a comedy. There's a lot of comedy in this, and I know it's a serial killer of women and all that. That's the serious part. But like the way that these guys go about their job is like really like, you know, he and this and his partner is like really eager to like kick anybody that's a suspect. And like, you'll see him just come in, like they're playing a good cop, bad cop thing. And the guy's like playing a good cop and the bad cop comes down and just immediately just kicks the guy. And that's becomes his MO all the way through it. This one guy is just like kicking people all the way through it. But there's this one serious guy who's like really following actual leads, but they just still can't find this person at all. And then you're beginning to wonder if there's even any real way to connect it all and everything. I'm kind of being purposefully vague because I don't want you to like, I want you to experience this for yourself.
Sure.
But if you like any Bong Joon-ho movie at all, you know, you've seen Parasite, you've seen Snowpiercer, all those movies.
Yeah.
You're going to love Memories of Murder. It's got just enough of the like, oh, what's going on here? You're really excited about them solving the mystery, and it's got a lot of humor in it, and it's just an excellent, excellent movie. So I highly recommend this one for you, Jeremy. I know for a fact that you would love this movie.
I have no doubt you are correct. And I will grab a bag of pink Himalayan sea salt and pepper pistachios and watch this movie. Yeah, that's great. I need to go back down his filmography before he started making American visible films, I guess.
Yep.
All right. I guess now we're ready to move on to the biggity big.
The big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Blood Diamond. Mm-hmm. 2006. Ed Zwick, master storyteller. And one thing that I have learned in my research is that, thank God, Jaimon Hansu was nominated for an Oscar for this movie for supporting actor.
Yeah. And
watching it through this viewing, it'd probably been 7-8 years since I'd seen it. that was the biggest thing that stood out to me, was what an impressive performance he gives, almost overshadowing fucking Leonardo DiCaprio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we open with Jaimon. His character is Solomon Vandy, and he lives in a village in Sierra Leone. Most of the movie is going to take place in Sierra Leone, and it takes place during a real factual civil war period in that country that went from the early 90s to the early 2000s. This is set in 99. The characters are fictional, but the setting, the RUF army that you see a bunch, all that is real. He's coming home from a day of fishing and his son from a day of school, and there's a good father-son bonding moment, and then the RUF attacks. What the RUF is basically doing is intimidating citizens, and they like to conscript some of them to be soldiers. They like to basically kidnap some of them to be workers in the diamond mines, and they like to cut off hands of others so that they won't be able to vote. Again, that is a real thing that was going on in Sierra Leone at this time in the world. Well, his family gets away, but Solomon is taken prisoner and sent to work in these diamond mines. We then cut to Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Danny Acha, landing on a dirt airstrip, and he's here to talk to Commander Zero. And there's a tough guy, sergeant out front, what did he call himself? Captain Rambo. And he tries to make himself the leader, and you can't see, talk to Commander Zero. You got to talk to me. And Danny basically disarms himself and just walks by that guy. He's going to go talk to Commander Zero no matter what. He's a smuggler. He gets some diamonds from this guy, and then we cut to him walking like some kind of shepherd with goats up over a grassy mountainside. And listen, I mean, I was not there at this time, but I would have to believe if I'm a white person trying to smuggle diamonds, I would not go with native shepherd as my disguise. Although, yes, I think he was assuming no one's even going to see me, but no, right. Lo and behold, military shows up. They feel on the goats because this is apparently not the first time this has happened, and they find diamonds sutured under the goat's skin, and they arrest Danny Archer and take him to jail. We go back to Jaimon Solomon working in the diamond mines. He's already seen a fellow worker grab and try and keep a diamond for himself, putting it in his mouth. And the leader of the camp, whose name is Captain Poison, they all have raddest names, shoots and kills that guy. So when Solomon finds a gigantic pink diamond in his little working thing, he's got a little scooper he's scooping river water out with, he decides to keep it. This is sort of how desperate these situations are. I mean, it's a movie for me, but in real life, there are people like Solomon who have been enslaved to work in mineral mines. It's just boggles the mind. Anyway, there's an explosion nearby, which gives him just enough time to put it down under his toes. And he's got some pretty dexterous toes, to be honest. And then he immediately asks to use the bathroom. Always a little bit suspicious, if you ask me. And Captain Poison stops him halfway up. Is it Captain Poison?
Yeah,
I'm wrong. Okay,
it's the leader of that RUF unit.
Captain Poison. And he stops him and says, give it to me, or show me your hands. And he like shows him his hands, and he doesn't have any diamonds. And he's like, all right, be quick about it. But Captain Poison, he still knows something's up. And so Jaimon goes around and tries to bury it. And then Captain Poison shows up. He's like, give it to me. And right then, there's like another attack on the mine. And Captain Poison is knocked to the ground. And these are actually military forces. These aren't RUF. This is
they're the government.
Government forces. And so Solomon is able to bury the diamond before he is captured. And he ends up in the same prison as Danny Archer and Captain Poison. And Captain Poison, in my opinion, somewhat stupidly, starts challenging Solomon in front of all the other prisoners. He says, that man has a diamond. He buried it. I'll give you $1,000 to anyone who cuts it out of him. And there's this awesome scene where Jaimon just strips himself naked immediately and goes, where is the diamond? Where is the diamond? And it's enough to make everyone except Danny Archer believe there really is no diamond. And Danny is, he's been around the block a few times. He's got connections. He's got friends, both in good places and in bad places. He's able to get himself out of that prison pretty quickly. And he tells the guy that gets him out, go get out Solomon Vandy. He's got a diamond. And I'm going to have him take me to it. And so I've gotten ahead of myself in my notes. So Solomon's family, the mom and the two sisters have been taken to a refugee camp. But the son, Dia, is grabbed by the RUF.
Yep.
All right. Sorry. My notes, I'm completely lost in my notes right now. And so Dia is basically taken to be a young RUF soldier. And they start with indoctrination and some chanting. And they have him fire a gun blindfolded. And he takes it off to find out he's just killed someone.
The little
boy gives a great performance in this movie. It's largely wordless, but he has to convey a lot of emotions. Anyway, the city is sieged. There's actually a bar scene. Let me go back to the bar. Leo asks the bartender for a gun because they know each other, and he runs into Jennifer Connelly. Jennifer Connelly is an American journalist. They flirt for a little bit. He finds out she's a journalist. He's like, fuck you. She's like, come on. They meet back up at the bar again one more time as the city is about to fall. to the RUF forces coming in. And Solomon and Danny barely escape. It's actually a miracle they're not shot. Because they have to go, looks like miles through the city that's an active war zone.
They must dodge about 1,000 bullets.
What did I write down? Good radio, Jeremy. They've come to a bridge the next day, and thankfully there's a dead body nearby with a uniform on it, and Danny grabs the hat, puts it on Solomon, and basically they do a I'm your white prisoner thing, and they get about 5 steps from the guards, and Leo just shoots them. And the third one runs away, and Leo gets a rifle and kills him. And there's this beat where Solomon looks like he may understand that this kind of violence exists in the world, but he's not used to it, and he's not expecting it in that moment.
The way I read it too was that he, even though his mission is to get his son back, he didn't think it would cost people lives like this
in this way.
I think you can tell it kind of affects him. Like even though these guys are considered the enemy or whatever, he didn't want people to die like that. So.
No. And I think there's an arc for him too by the end, but we'll get to that in a minute.
Yep.
They join a caravan with other people who have been made refugees by the siege of the city. And that's where they meet back up with Maddie. That's Jennifer Connelly, the journalist. And she has some connections and gets a helicopter to take them to Guinea, where she has heard Solomon's family is. In exchange, Danny's going to help her with her story about the Blood Diamond trade that she's writing for a magazine. Perhaps the biggest miracle in the entire movie is that at this refugee camp with millions of people in it, Solomon stands at the gate and spots his family. They say walking up a million people. And I'm just like, they might have been farther from the gate. It's pretty lucky they were right there by the gate. Anyway, his wife comes running up. That's where they tell him that Dia was taken to go work in the mines and become a soldier. So now we have Solomon, Maddie, and Danny on the road together after the diamond, and I love this dynamic because all three of them needs help from one of the others. None of them can get what they want on their own. They are dependent on each other. They see some troops moving. They see some bombed out cars. They even take gunfire by other militants at one point. They crash into a hillside, escape on foot. And then they encounter these tribe people that you think are going to be really scary, but they just take them to a school where there's a nice, gentle headmaster who's trying to help the kids that don't get sold into soldier slavery to live as normal a life as possible. And we get a little bit of a breather here. We get a nice conversation between Maddie and Danny where in a lesser movie, they would just sleep together right here, I think. But this movie's more interested in the moral gray areas, and both of them have reason to be wary of the other. There's a wild theory on Reddit, not Reddit. I saw on IMDb that Danny Archer's character has HIV. And earlier in the film, there's a prostitute that says, "I'm HIV free." And he says, "I've heard that before." And then he doesn't sleep with, Maddie. And I just think that's a wild, like, to come up with that theory, I doubt that was intended. Anyway, the next day the headmaster's going to drive them to Kono, but there are 2 children with guns guarding the road that the headmaster, I don't know how this dude runs a successful school for broken children in the middle of the jungle while being this naive
about. I didn't get that either.
Kids with guns. Everyone in the car is like, "Oh fuck, we're screwed." And he's like, "They're just children. I'll roll down my window and get shot." And so he gets shot. Then they take off and make it to a military camp. And that's where we run back into the colonel. When we met the colonel earlier, when Danny flew to South Africa for a beat, and the colonel is the guy he was smuggling the goat gems for, but the goat gems were confiscated, so the colonel wants this blood diamond in exchange for the debt that Danny owes him.
Arnold Vosloo.
Yes, Arnold Vosloo, who of the Mummy fame and of the Bad from one season of 24.
Yeah, and did not realize that he was originally from South Africa as well. I did not realize that.
Oh, so. I did not realize that either. I didn't until just now. That's awesome. All right, so the Colonel is going to go wipe out the mines. He wants to get this diamond. Danny kind of double crosses him and steals the GPS and sneaks away with Solomon to go in on their own and not with the troops. The Colonel commands a private army. He's not with the government and he's not with the RUF. He is for hire. So we get a lot of, I think, really lovely interaction between Solomon and Danny in these vignettes as they're walking through the African countryside. And some of it's lighthearted. Are you sure you're not a reporter? You ask a lot of questions. There's a section where he asks Danny if he's married. And well, when you get the money from the diamond, then you will get a wife and children. And Danny's like, I don't think so. And they slowly let their guard down a little bit. I don't think they ever fully let their guard down with each other until the very, very end. But they're clearly starting to understand each other and share more than just a mission. And so they get to the camp. Solomon's using the binoculars to look for Dia, and Danny keeps saying, you're an idiot, man. He's not here. I'm going to call in an airstrike from the Colonel. I'll admit that I stole this GPS, but that I'm here, and they'll make a diversion. And then while they're attacking, we'll go sneak around by the river where you said you hid the diamond, and we'll get it. For now, let's fall asleep. And that was not very wise, because Solomon is gone when Leo wakes up. It's nighttime. Mm-hmm. It's raining. And Solomon is walking through the camp, carrying wood, pretending to work there. It says a lot about the power of fatherhood and family, what he ultimately puts himself through. And he does find Dia, and he tries to get him to come with him, but he underestimates the brainwashing. And Dia turns him in to Captain Poison. Danny is watching all this from the wings with a gun, but he's not really able to help right then. So the next morning, the attack helicopters show up. Really good timing again. And all fucking hell breaks loose. Danny ends up trying to chase down Dia. Dia doesn't know who he is or trust him, so he's running from him because he looks like a soldier. And Solomon finally gets his one-on-one with Captain Poison in the rain, in the mud, with a shovel. And there is a moment of pure guttural rage that Jaimon does as he's killing this man that gave me chills. Felt eerily real. I'm pretty certain Jaimon has never killed anybody with a shovel. I can go on the record with that. But that moment right there was just chill-inducing. So Captain Poison is out of the way, but the Colonel and his stupid goons show up. And Danny appears to, and maybe does, turn on Solomon. And he says, that kid right there is his kid. He'll do anything for that kid. He'll tell you where the stone is buried. He's already verbally worked out an agreement 60-40 with the Colonel once they find that stone. And then they get to where Solomon had buried it, and he digs a hole and says, somebody has taken it. No one's really buying that, but there's some awkward dialogue where Danny is able to at least communicate to Solomon.
I didn't get this either.
But he's like, right, hey, Solomon. And Solomon looks up at him and he doesn't understand what's been said. And yet there is clearly some shared understanding that we're going to fight back now. And he says, oh, there it is. And he gets the Colonel to lean down. And right then, Danny takes out a soldier, grabs a gun. The Colonel gets hit with a shovel. Two guys get shot. And it's very unrealistic.
I think the thing he says is I stopped smoking is what he says to kind of relay the idea. And I think the idea is he had just previously said, I need to stop smoking. So right. I think the idea is he's lying and he knows he's lying, and that there's that sort of the cue that, you know, we need to be dishonest here or whatever. But it was tough to figure out exactly. He knew exactly what this needed to entail or whatever, but
So they get out of it. And then they turn and Dia is pointing a gun at Danny. And Solomon prepares to talk him down from that. And then Dia turns the gun on his own father, on Solomon. And this is in direct contrast to the guttural rage moment a few minutes earlier, because Jaimon goes quiet. Mm-hmm. He's like, you are a good boy. You like soccer and school. Your mom's by the fire making plantains with your sister. And he sheds this silent, huge tear that comes rolling down his cheek. And he talks Dia down. He reminds Dia who he is and who they, what they mean to each other. Mm-hmm. And then we're off. But Leo, Danny, has been shot in the fracas, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. he discovers. They got to get up on top of this hill because Danny's arranged his buddy, who I don't think we've ever met before, with a plane to pick him and the diamond up. That guy advises him to ditch the fisherman and his son, but he does not. And near the top of the mountain, Leo realizes he can't make it. He's done. Mm-hmm. And so he gives the diamond back to Solomon and tells him, go get on the plane. And Solomon doesn't understand at first. But then some shots ring out because the colonel's soldiers are still after them. So he is convinced, and he and his son go running up the mountain. Danny uses his last breaths to call Maddie, who's back in London, and tell her she needs to go to Guinea and pick up Solomon and help him because he's bringing something with him. And she knows what that means. And he says, it's a story now. And you can write the hell out of it. I'm right where I need to be. And he dies. And we get this lovely little wrap up with Solomon in London and a little bit of subterfuge to set up the diamond. God, who the fuck is that? It's the guy from Tron that I love so much.
What, Michael Sheen?
Michael Sheen. she takes some photographs while he and Solomon negotiate. and then the story breaks that she writes in the magazine. And the final scene is Solomon being introduced at some sort of summit in South Africa about the diamond trade. This is supposed to be a stand-in for a very real summit that did take place called the Kimberley, South Africa, the Kimberley Process Certification Scheme, which sought to certify the origin of rough diamonds in order to curb the trade in conflict diamonds. So again, the character Solomon is fictional, and him being there is fictional, but that conference was a very real thing that did affect change in the nation, mm-hmm. Of Sierra Leone and beyond. So that is my wrap-up walkthrough. I've got a few notes for later, but what are your general thoughts of The Blood Diamond?
This movie is great. I didn't realize it. I didn't remember it being this great. I saw this back when it opened, and I was at my new theater in New York at the time this came out. It was my Atlas Park theater that I was working at when I saw this. And it's not a movie to watch late at night like I did back in the day when you're a projectionist just making sure prints are okay. This is not the type of movie to do that on. One day, I guess, I don't know, I'll have time to kind of like write down a whole bunch of fleshed out thoughts for a Wreckatopia. Usually I'm kind of going off the cuff and everything, and I'd be doing that here. There's so many things about this movie. Everybody in this feels like they're doing something fairly hopeless. I'll start with Jennifer Connelly's character. There's several moments where they're talking about what she does, and she says to DiCaprio at one point, she says that she'll write about the victims, and that, you know, and people will be upset about it. They might even write a check. But what I need to actually, and this is the parenthetical phrase that we don't hear, to effect change, is I need bank accounts. I need things that tie things to rich people who are creating an environment for this type of market to flourish. And she doesn't get to make any change unless there's somebody like Leo in here who is willing to exchange his livelihood essentially for her story. And And I sit here and I go, man, that Archer is not like, by the end of it, we look at him as kind of a hero. He does the right things, but he only does it when he's dying.
Yeah.
I think that's something that's kind of a hard, that's something that's going to be hard to get through a lot of people's heads on this, is that he's not really in it to do the right thing ever. Until it's just very, that when he doesn't have any reason to continue doing what he's doing, and he knows he's going to die. That's the only time he does the right thing.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of the other thing with Connolly, but there's also a moment, where Jaimin Hounsou, he gets to London, and he sees a display case with all the, like, this, like, really well put together diamond necklace and a couple other diamond encrusted things.
Yeah.
And you can see on his face, this is what people are dying for, is this, to be displayed in a case for people to spend extravagant amount of money on. One of the other things that they talk about is how diamonds aren't rare. This is something that a lot of people should know by now, is that diamonds aren't rare. The value of a diamond is complete bullshit. And yet you have companies like these that are in the movie. I think there's a sort of a veiled reference here to De Beers or somebody like that. When they're talking about these companies, but, you know, their whole business is to make it seem like they're rare and precious, so that people will spend tons of money on engagement rings and other kinds of jewelry.
They even show the pink diamond in this movie at the end being wheeled into a vault to be shut away forever, so that the value of diamonds everywhere else go up.
Yeah, yeah. There's a number of things in here too, where a bunch of people who are native Africans will give the TIA, this is Africa, slogan. I think everybody who mentions that dies in the movie. I think everybody who says that dies. The bartender at the beginning, where he and DiCaprio have this thing. It's such a heart disheartening thing to watch this vibrant place. Like, everybody's having a great time. They're like, you know, it's like there's partying, dancing and all that. And then just completely ruined.
Yep.
And you see that bartender in a cutaway shot, just dead at his bar. And this is right after he said something about, I'm staying here forever. Yeah. This is my home, all that, you know, and Ara Vosloo tells DiCaprio at one point, like, the color of the soil here is because of all the blood we've shed for it and everything. Of course, DiCaprio is holding soil, which is then later on when he's dying and he's bleeding into the soil. It tells you that once again, Vosloo himself, who is Mr. like, you're never leaving this continent and all that.
Yep.
He ends up dying. Of course, he says the TIA thing right before he dies, but, that's a really neat action scene, by the way. I think there's some slick editing involved. I'm not sure exactly how DiCaprio got around to the other angle, but it's a really cool one anyway. But yeah, even he dies, and the whole thing that Vosloo is doing there, he's selling weapons to the RUF, and he's making this conflict worse, but he's getting rich from it.
Mm-hmm.
But he's selling weapons to the RUF, but then he's helping the government fight the RUF.
Yeah.
And it's just, and this is all because of something that's not that rare. It really, really is depressing as hell when you think about it.
Yeah.
And there's so many things about this movie that I would love to just deep dive into, as far as the meanings that are concerned with everybody's, you look at DiCaprio through this movie and you're like, why would anyone do this? I mean, yeah, he's got some bucks, but man, you think about the very first time we see him is the thing that we're talking about, where he goes up to the Captain Rambo guy. Mm-hmm. He has to first get past that asshole, and he has to like that guy, I mean, luckily that guy's got that kind of demeanor. Who knows what some other person might have, right. Shoot him right there on the spot, but he knows it. I guess he knows the situation just enough to be able to say, all right, I'm just going to disarm myself and walk past you. But he, not only does he have to get past that, but then he gets to the one guy who is inordinately short, by the way. I'm wondering if they did that on purpose. Like, how in the world, this guy must be a rough motherfucker to be the head of this RUF unit, to be like, he's so this tiny. Yeah. he's like even trying to hold out on DiCaprio with all the diamonds, and then DiCaprio's like, all right, why don't I just go to the government with what I've got? And then it's like, okay, and he gives him more diamonds. So he has to go through all of that negotiation. Then you think about the putting the diamonds in the goats.
Yeah.
And having to cross the border and all the other things. He describes the process to Jennifer Connelly in this movie. Just all the things that happen with these diamonds once he finally gets it to the one place, and then it gets sorted, and then it gets mixed in with good diamonds and all that. It's like all of this is happening for something that isn't that rare. And it really, I mean, even if it was that rare, it wouldn't make it worth it. But I just keep on, I was just sitting there like just guffawing at the hopelessness that goes on in this. This is the reason why the Jaimin Hounsou character is in here. He seems to have the worst of it for the longest time, and in a situation that doesn't seem like it's very easy to get out of. And it wouldn't be. He's definitely an anomaly in this, because there's the other real people that he represents. They're never finding their family like he
right.
does.
Right.
But he's the one ray of hope in this whole movie. Everybody else has sort of like this, you know. I also like the Jennifer Connelly line in there too, where DiCaprio's trying to get her to help because he needs to find his family and all that. And she goes, she's like, entire country's at war. Why should I help one person? And there's a 5-second pause. And then she's like, I don't know why I said that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, there's just so many people just out for it, out for what, you know, looking out for themselves and whatever. And it's the kind of environment that has been created, and it's really depressing. And I'm glad that something has been done, although this Kimberly process, from what I understand, didn't end up working very well.
Yeah.
I don't think they've abandoned the Kimberly process, and you as the consumer have to ensure that if you're buying a diamond, that it's a conflict-free one. I don't know how you do that, by the way, but you have to ensure that yourself. But anyway, this is a great movie that I should have given a lot more attention to back in 2006. And
it's great. Really glad that you enjoyed it. I don't understand. I mean, again, IMDb has it at an 8, which is, you know, and even a 6 or 7 something on IMDb is good. And I don't understand the Rotten Tomatoes score 63, but
yeah,
I am convinced now that this movie is definitely good, and I'm glad that we got to revisit it
again. Yeah, 8.0 on the IMDb is ridiculous. And
yeah, that's
I remember this movie getting mixed to good reviews.
Yeah,
back in the day, and that's what the Rotten Tomatoes score reflects is what people felt like at the time. When you look at the IMDb score, you see a wide, you know, you have 16, 17 years worth of people coming in, and you see movies a lot of times like Blood Diamond. I'm sure Blood Diamond, if you looked at it 10 years ago, it's probably like 6.9, 7.0, somewhere in that area. And now it's 8.0 because people are discovering it and realizing how good it is.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. All right. What is the super secret double feature for the week?
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Interesting that the movie that came up is something that somebody came up with for, I believe, Ronin a couple of weeks ago.
Oh.
But the double feature that I came up with for this is Three Kings.
That's an awesome one.
Yeah, Three Kings has got the same kind of moral quandary that this movie does, in that, you know, you have three U.S. soldiers at the end of the Iraq War trying to steal Kuwaiti gold.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it's not theirs, but they figure there's a claim to it in some way that they can hold on to. But they realize that, you know, there's a bigger situation going on there than them stealing gold and being rich the rest of their lives. And Three Kings is something that I wouldn't be surprised if we big recommended at some point.
Yeah.
I feel like it has a lot of the same kind of ideas in that as well. And
yeah.
Once again, people, you know, seeking out something valuable, but they're also not in their homeland and it's not really theirs. And there's a bigger situation that they have to learn is going on here. So
you could argue that Clooney's arc is stronger in that movie because, like you pointed out, DiCaprio's character in Blood Diamond is in it for himself right up until he realizes he's about to die.
Mm-hmm.
I think he would have gotten on the plane with Solomon, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Clooney, he starts his journey almost right away in that first village that they're in. The only reason they have a skirmish is because they're going to kill this guy and he doesn't want them to. And there's mm-hmm. that Mexican standoff with all the guns. So he starts out with a little bit of a heart, even though they're selfishly going after gold. And by the end, all they care about is those refugees making it safely.
Yeah.
Excellent pick.
There's even reporters in this one too. Judy Greer plays one. Nora Dunn plays one.
Yep.
So you have some of that element in it as well. I don't think there's anybody. I don't remember. Nora Dunn might be like Jennifer Connelly in that movie, but I don't feel like she's put in the forefront as much as Connelly is in this movie.
No, not at all.
So anyway, excellent. All right.
Excellent.
I'm going to continue my comedies through the decades, and this is going to start getting really difficult. It's already super difficult now that we've gotten to the 30s.
Mm.
And I poured over the 30s. I was like, ah, maybe this one. Oh, maybe that one. And there's like 10 that I wanted to do. I'm going to have to revisit them at some point. But the idea for me was we've done Chaplin. We've done Buster Keaton. I didn't want to go back. I kind of wanted to go back to Chaplin because there's two really good ones that I wanted to do. But we should also seek out other comedians as well that were famous in this day. And one of them is the Marx Brothers. So I'm going to do a Marx Brothers movie. Duck Soup is going to be next week's big recommend. And I hope that everybody's kind of enjoying this. This is a tough one, man. I was sitting there like City Lights. There's The Awful Truth. There's all sorts of, that's a Cary Grant movie. There's so many movies I wanted to do, but I was like, you know what? We're going to make this broad ranging. We're going to go through as many of these big comedians as we can in these early days and try to get them all if we can. Cause I'm sure I'm going to try to get Abbott and Costello in there. I'm going to try to get a lot of people. So there you go. Duck Soup is next week's big recommend.
Duck Soup.
You can find it on Amazon. I didn't find it anywhere else. So if you have the Prime membership, you can watch this for free. I'm sure that there's places to rent it, but it's a very brisk hour and 9 minute movie, something like that. So there you go.
All right. Yeah, rentable from all the usual places, free for Prime subscribers. And let's do a question. I'm going to skip the first one because it'll take too long. We'll get that one in there one of these days.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Mm-hmm. What are your favorite blink and you miss it moments from the background of movies?
Now I don't know how specific it has to be that it has to be in the background, but a few things that triggered in my head on this. I got a couple that are in the background, but then there's another one that's like a cutaway. One of my favorite things in Scott Pilgrim versus the World is when they go to that Battle of the Bands thing, and Allison Pill That other band is playing. Allison Pill is on the back, is in the side of the stage, and she's like, "They have a girl drummer," and it's like this really like 8-year-old girl that's playing drums for them. And she hates the fact that they have a girl drummer, and so you kind of like forget all about this, and Sex Bomb gets onto the stage, and Allison Pill starts drumming and all this. And there's like the song starts getting really like intense and everything. And there's a cutaway to the little girl drummer from the other band scowling at Allison Pill as the song goes on. I love that part of the movie. The part where Jim Carrey is basically playing Fire Marshal Bill in the background of Liar Liar when it's right after that airplane scene towards the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And I think it's right after he's like, "You're all doing a wonderful job." And then and it cuts to something where Jim Carrey's not on screen, like his character's not on screen, but in the background you can see his Fire Marshal Bill character from In Living Color sitting there on a radio saying a whole bunch of like fake stuff. That's a funny thing. And then Steve Buscemi playing the Buddy Holly waiter in Pulp Fiction. There's a point where John Travolta says, "We're lucky we got anything. I don't think Buddy Holly is a very good waiter." Later on, you see Buddy Holly in the background of the scene, just taking a smoke break. He's just sitting there. So I really love that part in it. So there, those are the few that I came up with.
I only came up with one, but I love it. And it's early on in that thing you do where Jonathan Sketch, how do you say his name?
Yeah, I think that's right.
And Steve's on and Liv Tyler are having a conversation in the foreground about what to name the band. And he's like, "What if it's like the Herdsmen, but like instead of H-E-R-D, it's H-E-A-R-D, like you heard our music." And in the background are the bass player and the drummer. Bass player is Ethan Embry. He's just standing there. The drummer is Giovanni Ribisi, and he's jumping over parking meters. And it focuses on them and leaves the foreground conversation people blurry just as he jumps over a parking meter and boom, falls off screen. And that is crucial because he breaks his arm and they have to go recruit the other drummer to be their Spartacus and take them. And I always laugh at that because the first time through you're like, why are they focusing on the all right, let's do one more.
All right,
what movie would end fastest if all the characters behaved logically?
I don't think this is probably the best example, but the one that I thought of on this one was Suicide Squad, because there's a part in the movie where a Waller goes to all those like government types or whatever, and is like, and she's like, "I'm going to have to release a whole bunch of bad people who can help us do this or whatever." And I remember when we send this, my sin was no, and then the end was the sin was like no, we're not going to give you all these dangerous fucking criminals just to fight these people off. And then by the end of the movie, in the mid-credit scene, Waller's talking to Batman, or talking to Bruce Wayne, who she knows is Batman, and saying like, you know, like he's like, "Oh, I know some people who I can form a Justice League with." And I'm like, why didn't you do this in the first place? if you knew Bruce Wayne was Batman, then why didn't you just go ahead and do that?
You know, and start with the prisoners.
Right. Instead, you were like, "Let's break a whole bunch of dangerous ass criminals out to fight this witch." And like, I sit there and I'm thinking, like, that movie should have ended either one of two ways. It should have either been like, everybody's like, "No, we're not going to give you these prisoners," and then the witch wins, I guess, unless there's got to be some other superhero out there that's going to help them out, is my point. But the other point is like, this should just be a Justice League thing, or it should be a Batman thing. And just, you know, that movie should never exist. I never understood that. But anyway, I don't think it's the best example I can come up with. I think there are other movies that are probably way better. And I probably even made this argument with other movies before, but that was the one that came to mind.
I settled on Alien. You can go to the end of Alien and wind it all the way back to the decision to leave the ship, which Ripley tells them not to do repeatedly, and they do anyway. And then to compound, that's the biggest one, but to compound that, the most blatant one is he fucking touches an alien egg. He's like, oh, I'm gonna touch that with my glove. And then now how many movies later worth of trauma has humanity endured, all because they wouldn't just stay on the ship like Ripley fucking told him to. Anyway.
Exactly. Looks like a couple of couple of answers over in the chat. The Avengers Endgame, Captain Marvel should have ended it immediately. Yeah, absolutely. She's off doing some other thing, right? She's doing other thing. She's busy. I don't know. And then JC says Wrath of Khan. If one person paid attention to their astronomy lessons, they'd sure know it was it wasn't SETI Alpha 6, or Chekhov remembering where they left Khan. Yeah, obviously. which that's a weird thing in Star Trek, right? Because Chekhov wasn't a part of the original Star Trek. But then there was people have tried to explain it over the years that, oh, he would have known about Khan and Khan would have known about him through, I don't know, osmosis, I guess. There's always an explanation, but he wasn't a part of the original Star Trek where Khan showed up in the series or whatever. So I don't know. It's one of those weird things, but yeah, exactly. Just a little bit of thought in that process. They would have not done that. You're right.
Indeed.
Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you for
coming out today and watching us. Next week is going to be Duck Soup. Looking forward to that one. Thank you guys. We'll see you.
Bye everybody.
Bye.
See you next week.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Dancing cheek to cheek and pants to pants. There's a lot to be said for the army. I think we should file a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
We should. Yeah, I got nothing. Your baseball team is doing really well lately.
Yeah, they are. I always temper my excitement about this type of stuff, especially early in the season. But yeah. They're doing well. I'm excited for them. I think when your team wins the World Series, you kind of just take this regular season with a grain of salt. Like,
sure.
They in 2021, they were really good. I mean, they had a really good final 2 months and got into the playoffs as a wild card and then managed to just somehow steamroll through the playoffs and you can have a team that just absolutely dominates the whole season and then you get into a small series and it can be over in a minute. So
in a New York minute? Well, I mean, I feel like hockey's a long season and they play twice as many games in baseball. So even in hockey, even halfway through the season, I'm generally not super worried about what the record is because it's such a streaky game. You can turn it on in February and make it into the playoffs. And baseball's twice as long, at least in terms of number of games. That's just wild to me.
It's like, Boston had a historic hockey season, and it could be over in this next series. I mean, they won last night, but like, it could be over this series. That's how fickle everything is. And I kind of understand the people who really love soccer. Now, I like soccer system of relegation and whoever had won the season is the champion and everything. I do like that. I guess it really depends on your love of soccer, AKA football. I kind of wish, the United States could do that with some of their sports, but we love the playoffs so much that I don't think we'd ever get to that point where a season is what determines the winner. But you see how the Premier League and everything is when once they get down to certain games, it's like the playoffs. It's just not.
It is.
It's not like a. It's just not a series of games against one opponent that could knock you out. You know, it's there's a whole bunch of things that go on in the Premier League that just as exciting as playoffs can be. Anyway. Yeah, I do. I like the idea of relegation and things like that. So you don't have teams that tank and teams that just kind of I don't know if they're stealing money or if they're just – I don't know what they're doing. You know, they're right. always not competitive. They never can be competitive for whatever reason. And, yeah, maybe it's because they – I guess they always claim no money, but you know that these big owners have money. They're just not wanting to spend it. Like even the worst team you can think of right now. Oh well, they're a small market team. Yeah, they're owned by a billionaire. To me, it's insane that you would say I'm not going to spend any money to make my team good, and I'm not going to try to benefit from the ticket sales that's going to generate when I have all these players. It was sad, man, when I went to go see an Oakland game back in the day. They were in first place, and this was like middle of the season, mid to late season, somewhere around there. It's hardly anybody in the ballpark, man. So it's a possibility that there's a variety of things going on with Oakland. I've always heard about their stadium issues. I went to the stadium. I thought it was fine. It is antiquated compared to any other stadium, though.
Yeah.
And, you know, shitty.
But if
you
want to have, like, dozens of feral cats at some point in the last couple of years that were like living in the stadium.
Don't doubt it. I didn't see that myself. the thing with Oakland for the longest time is like they've wanted to build a new stadium, but then taxpayers don't want to foot the bill for the stadium, which is understandable. And then so people don't want to go out there to watch a game. Although I don't know if the same can be said for the Golden State Warriors, who played right across the fucking way from the A's. So
yeah, and they sell pretty well. Right?
I would figure they do, right? So yeah. maybe have a product on the field that people like to go see. I don't know, man. That's a complex situation, but I always feel like I'm always on the side of fans and players when it comes to stuff like this. Yeah. Never on the side of the owners, really. You know, this was the same thing we were talking about with movie theaters that, you know, especially our old company Regal that wouldn't open up certain concession stands, and they're like, well, we made this much money in concessions, and so we only need this amount of people to run it to make that same amount of money and make a profit. And then they don't ever think about the amount of money that they lose when people walk in and they see the lines. And
no.
So
because the people who make those decisions at the home office, the last time they were in a theater on a Friday night and not for leisure was years ago.
Yeah, exactly. They're looking at a piece of paper and they're saying, I don't know, man, we had way too many people for the amount of money that we made. Well, imagine taking out – I always wonder if they ever – they don't. They know. I know they don't. If they took out the two or three concession employees that they're dreaming about taking out of on their per cap or whatever, and they see would they still see the same amount of money? They wouldn't, because you have people who would not want to stand in the longer lines for it. They don't understand that concept. So –
there's a lot they don't understand. I was told when I became a GM, this district manager said to me, now when it would get to capital expenditure season, which was only a couple months away, he was like, ask for whatever you want, because they say yes to first-time general managers a lot because they want to empower you to make your dent on the building or what have you. And I was like, so if the guy before me hadn't been fired, they wouldn't have given the money to fix the roof. But now that he was fired, they'll give us money to fix the roof.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really dumb way to go about making those. Like, you should give it to the roof that needs the fixing the most and not like the tenure of the GM at the building. It's just such that the the entire decision-making matrix in that business from top down has always boggled my mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I gotta get out there and swing some golf clubs and throw some discs.
Mm-hmm.
Golf discs. I gotta do all the golf things.
Yes. Yes.
I'm going to hit my golf discs with my golf club.
Throw the disc up in the air and hit it with the golf club.
Pull.